from WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He's been working the crowd for years, but this time, on his latest tour of the United States, it seems inarguable, Tibet's Dalai Lama has become something like an American icon. What were the odds of a Himalayan Buddhist god king packing in stadium crowds in the USA? And why now? Tonight on Point, America's fascination with Tibet's top Buddhist. But first, in a very worldly realm, on the eve of President Bush's address to the United Nations, I spoke with Richard Wolff, chief diplomatic correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I asked him what the UN expects to hear tomorrow from the president.
What it would like to hear is some sense of contrition. Remember, this time last year, President Bush warned the United Nations that if it didn't come along with the United States, it would be irrelevant. It would become like the League of Nations. Mm-hmm. So what they would like to see is some humility. I don't think that's what they're going to get. Instead, they're looking for some sense of compromise, a role for the UN, a more explicit role for the UN in running Iraq.
Early signs are that President Bush will offer something in that regard.
Something, but not very much. What people would really like to see, there are two things. First of all, the United Nations staff itself, the people who work for the United Nations, are deeply concerned and in some senses traumatized by the attacks on the UN, both this week and, of course, last month's terrible attack. And what they would like to see is something very explicit about what the UN should be doing in Iraq. A lot of them blame the fudge, the gray area for the UN's role for the attack that happened last month. On the other side, the countries, the heads of state who are coming, would like to see power out of America's hands and in the hands of Iraqis and the UN. And I have to say, the Bush administration is willing to give the UN staff what it wants, but not the world leaders what they want.
President Bush has been telling Fox News in advance of his appearance that he would be prepared to allow the UN to oversee post-war elections in Iraq when they come.
Yeah, that kind of a practical role is definitely on the agenda in terms of what the administration, particularly Secretary of State Colin Powell, is negotiating right now. But the bigger point is who has political power? And I'm afraid a number of nations led by France think that America is ill-placed and badly positioned to actually run Iraq. Of course, the Bush administration strongly disagrees.
Washington has a resolution before the Security Council now. Richard Wolff, can you explain what it's seeking and where it stands?
It's seeking to encourage nations to provide troops and cash to help with Iraq's reconstruction and security. Where it stands is that, you know, after the attack on the UN, Colin Powell thought that he had a lot of momentum, could come to a quick agreement on this kind of resolution. That hasn't happened. It's still being thrashed out. And again, it boils down to who should have power in Iraq. I'm afraid that philosophical debate is not something either Mr. Powell or President Bush is willing to do right now.
The White House had hoped that the resolution would be passed before the president speaks tomorrow. It's not. What's the prognosis?
Prognosis is it still has some way to go. I think, in fact, what we've seen is although countries such as France have really hardened their position, there is some wiggle room. In particular, President Chirac gave an interview to the New York Times and said quite clearly he would not veto this resolution. There is a sense that people want to move beyond the old rancorous debate of the pre-war period. But in fact, in moving beyond that, they're not actually prepared to do very much. So I expect there to be a vote, a resolution, sometime in the next couple of weeks. But it actually won't change that much on the ground in Iraq.
Because there still won't be a UN umbrella thrown over this?
Yeah, the umbrella is going to be very flimsy. There won't be a UN control. Everything will still be in the hands of Paul Bremer, the leading American administrator, and the Iraqi governing council, but really in the hands of Paul Bremer. That's not enough for a number of countries to contribute troops. And I think, frankly, the administration has scaled back its expectations of the troops and the cash it thinks it can raise from the rest of the world.
Richard Wolff, the UN is so big and represents nearly the entire world, so this may be an unfair question, but is there a sense at the UN now of whether Iraq is an issue of such seriousness that it needs to get in with the United States and help it succeed there, or whether there's still bitterness over what happened last fall and a desire for the United States to take some more punishment there?
Well, at the level of the countries, the kind of world leaders we're seeing roll up into New York right now, there is a sense of not wanting to punish America, not wanting to have another bitter dispute, But that's about as far as it goes. That's not a very optimistic basis for moving forward. It's not about coming together. It's not as if the whole world, the international community, feels that this is their fight. As yet, President Bush may change their minds tomorrow, but really there is still a sense of bitterness and resentment about the way the war was conducted. And so there isn't a coming together at the moment. There's, an agreement not to carry on fighting, but that's a long way from saying, let's all get in here together.
And it's a long way from putting up troops and putting up mountains of cash to help out Washington.
Exactly. And remember, Washington's talking about huge numbers. The request they've made for $87 billion from the U.S. Congress is just staggering for most countries. And there's no hope that the world community could, even with a lot of goodwill, could ever come close.
So President Bush is going to stay on after his speech for a couple of days, arm-twisting and talking with leaders of France, Germany, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. Where will he do that? And is that entirely outside the camera's glare?
No, there will be some pictures there. It'll go on in hotels around in Manhattan, notably at the Waldorf Astoria, where Colin Powell is also going to be doing some work. But I would expect, you know, there will be some good news out of that. There's a very public kiss and make up with Germany. Chancellor Gerhard Schröder is being brought back into the fold after a very chilly reception he had when he was running for re-election this time last year. France is going to be very different. We'll have to look very closely at the body language to see whether Chirac and President Bush are ever going to make up there.
Richard Wolff, always good to hear from you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff is chief diplomatic correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from New York. When he first visited the United States in 1978, after trying to get a visa for almost 20 years, his supporters had a hard time getting anyone to even interview him. Now, Tibet's Dalai Lama is packing stadiums and filling Central Park. Tickets to his lectures go like hotcakes on eBay. He is a best-selling author. His smiling image appears in national ad campaigns. America's fascination with the Dalai Lama and his friendly brand of Buddhism and compassion is at an all-time high. Sellout crowds want to know what Tibet's God King thinks about life, work, and even America's war in Iraq.
War is, I think, something like legalized violence.
So are you on the Dalai Lama bandwagon, and what does this Tibetan Buddhist leader stand for to you? Is the Dalai Lama a real force for peace, a feel-good self-help guru? Is he both? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Jeffrey Payne, author of Re-Enchantment, Tibetan Buddhism Comes to the West. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Payne.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us.
My
also
pleasure.
With us, oh, it's good to have you. Also with us tonight from New York is Howard Cutler, co-author with the Dalai Lama of The Art of Happiness, which was on the New York Times bestseller list for almost 2 years. And more recently, the two have teamed up again for the book, The Art of Happiness at Work. Good evening and welcome, Howard Cutler.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us. Howard Cutler, to you first. As I understand it, you've been traveling with the Dalai Lama some on his tour, still ongoing for a couple more days of the United States. Give us a sense of the tour. What's it been like out there? What kind of reception has he had?
Well, tremendous reception, actually. Wherever he goes, people just seem to have this wonderful sort of warm response to him. He's been doing a variety of different things, from interfaith services at the National Cathedral to a Mind and Life conference there. I think you're in Boston, right?
Yes.
So there in Boston, he did a conference with some of the world's top scientists, met with President Bush in Washington and Colin Powell. So he's been doing a variety of things, but seems to get an enthusiastic response wherever he goes.
And have you traveled with him on previous visits? Can you remember when the stadiums weren't packed? In fact, they weren't in stadiums at all?
Well, I sort of tagged along on his U.S. tour in 2001, which was the last time that he was here, and he had huge crowds then. I first met him in 82, so, you know, that's going back quite a few years, but I didn't go on any of his first visit to the U.S. or anything like that, so I don't know what it was like back then, but as you suggested at the opening, I think things were a lot more low-key in those days.
So you must feel this swelling of interest that it appears so obvious in all the footage we see of his meetings and in just the numbers of turnout.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yesterday in Central Park, it was unbelievable. I think they estimated 65,000 people were there, and just the weather was perfect. People seemed to be in a good mood, very responsive to his talk and his message, and it's really amazing.
Among non-entertainment draws at Central Park, if I may put it that way, I understand reading here that only Billy Graham and the Pope have drawn bigger crowds. Jeffrey Payne, when you look at the history of Tibetan Buddhism since its violent interaction with modern China, what were the odds that the Dalai Lama, any Dalai Lama, would end up, you know, in the year 2003 at the head of such a big parade in the United States of America?
Think of the largest number you can, and then it was one against that number.
Not great odds.
Not great odds. When the Dalai Lama had to flee Tibet in 1959, no one knew anything about what Tibetan Buddhism was. It was largely dismissed as black magic and superstition. Tibet was a fairly prosperous, happy country, but it was not a modern country. They didn't have the wheel there, and they had no interest in the outside world, and the religion is very, very complicated. So the chances of it survive, well, it was obvious what was going to happen. It was just going to perish the way all conquered religions have since the Aztecs and the Incas. And the likelihood of it surviving would have been if we go back to the 16th century, if suddenly in London, Londoners started declaring themselves Neo-Incans or worshipping at the Church of Quetzalcoatl.
So what do you make of it? Why has I don't know whether to ask whether this religion or this man or this American version of the religion and man, you help us frame it, but why has it been such a hit?
Well, it was a meeting of two different things. One is he was such a good exemplar of his religion, but not unique. What is unique is the spotlight was on him and he was dealing with politics. The Tibetans and he himself had every reason to be the most miserable man in the world, seeing his culture, everything he loved, destroyed. And yet he's in a very good cheer. He doesn't put himself forward. He doesn't put his cause forward. He just meets whoever, you know, who's ever in contact with as though they're the most important person in the world. He's kind of a bon vivant. It's like the Tibetans suffered the trials of Job, and yet they acted like a tribe of Walt Whitman's, and this attracted the interest of the world that he and the other Tibetans were able to have this happy facade, though being weighed down with everything. It seemed like they knew something about the secret of outwitting tragedy. That's half the story. The other half of the story would require a small historical detour because he meets the West at a particular point. Do you want me to go into that for a minute?
Well, just give it just in 1 minute. But you mean when he's campaigning for a free Tibet?
No, I don't mean when he's campaigning for a free Tibet. His campaigning for a free Tibet would not have the resonance it was if it was entirely self-centered campaign. It kind of rides upon the interest in the religion and his disinterestedness and his interest in spirituality and all suffering people and the state of the world, so that people become interested in the religion and become attracted by this. This is not a world actually with overflowing with heroes. And here's this man who seems happy and flawless. And the more you know about him, the more remarkable. So that attracts people to the free Tibet cause.
So it's the personality drawing there, at least in part. We've just got a few seconds before the break, Howard Cutler. But in a nutshell, how do you explain the magnetism in an American context of the Dalai Lama?
Well, in a way, it's somewhat of a mystery. I agree with the things Jeffrey was saying. But partly it's that people sense that his genuineness, his down-to-earthness, that here's a person that walks his talk, that really is in his personal life, exemplifies the values that he talks about, and people want that in their own lives, and he gives them hope.
We're going to come back and dig in both into the Buddhism that the Dalai Lama represents and to the phenomenon of his current popularity in the United States. We're looking tonight at the Dalai Lama boom. My guests are Jeffrey Payne and Howard Cutler. You can join the conversation as well. Are you on the Dalai Lama bandwagon? And what does this Buddhist leader stand for to you? Why does the Dalai Lama's popularity appear to be soaring in the USA? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Dalai Lama boom. My guests are Jeffrey Payne, joining us from Washington, author of Reenchantment, Tibetan Buddhism Comes to the West. And from New York, Howard Cutler, co-author with the Dalai Lama of The Art of Happiness at Work and the bestseller The Art of Happiness. The Dalai Lama, spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism, has been popular in America for years, but fascination with him is at an all-time high. People are lining up to hear him speak. Last week in Medford, Massachusetts, he had this to say.
Faith, compassion, all these are the old tradition, you see, talks about these things and actually practicing. But Buddhist way is use human intelligence maximum. Then through that way, you see, develop certain sort of conviction. And that eventually sort of transform our emotion, even faith, with help of reasons, compassion, with help of reasons.
The Dalai Lama last week on his big tour of the United States. You can join our conversation tonight. Why does the Dalai Lama's popularity appear to be soaring in the United States? And is it a passing fad or a serious new factor in American life? Did you see the Dalai Lama on his current tour? What was the message? What was the mood? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeffrey Payne, for those listeners who may not have had anything to do with the Dalai Lama or Tibetan Buddhism or Buddhism at all, how would you say this is what Tibetan Buddhism is? What's the vehicle the Dalai Lama rides in on?
What is the vehicle he rides in on is, well, to go back to the Buddha 2,500 years, the Buddha said he wasn't starting a new religion. He said, I'm here to teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and its cure. And the Dalai Lama has said that if the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of modern science contradict each other, the former, meaning the teachings of the Buddha, have to go, this is something pretty unique from a religious leader who's not putting religion first, but seemingly putting the welfare of people first. And this intersects American history going back to 1959, when it was assumed that religion was just on the way out, that universal prosperity and rationality, we're going to see the end of religion. In so many ways, we've seen that hasn't come true, that prosperity hasn't come true. And more people are speaking some kind of spirituality, but not necessarily without religion. And here is this welcoming figure, the Dalai Lama, who's not only who seems to know the secret of happiness, or the art of happiness in Howard Cutler's phrase, but who also says that, I have to, before my book comes out, I have to learn how to perfect my Dalai Lama accent.
But says, oh, boy, that'll sell.
Yeah, he says, but, you know, I like to joke, and he starts laughing. He says, I like to joke that religion is a luxury item, but kindness is not. And so here is someone who seems to be putting people, their needs first, and the dogma of his religion last.
Howard Cutler, I have to ask you just a very simple question. We've seen a lot of the Dalai Lama, but of this Dalai Lama, not of earlier Dalai Lamas, at least I haven't, and or even of other lamas that much in the United States, the worldly ones. Is he unique in his personality, or do all Dalai Lamas crack that big smile and you know, have that kind of gentle, laughing mischievousness? Or is this unique to this man?
Well, I think there are a lot of characteristics that are unique to him, but the type of thing you're talking about, that cheerfulness, that that good humor, that sense of happiness in the face of suffering and dealing with suffering, is not unique to him. I've met lots and lots of high lamas from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition that have the same type of thing, that emanate this wonderful sense of peace and this great sense of humor and this sort of practical, down-to-earth approach to life. So he's not unique in that. At least there's I've met a number of high lamas that are very, very special in the same way.
And Jeffrey Payne, you write that Tibetan Buddhism is at once the most mystical and the most earthy of all Buddhisms. What do you mean by that?
Tibetans are very, very practical people, and that's what first attracted people to them, including, I sort of start symbolically my story with the famous Catholic writer Thomas Merton, who went to the Himalayas in 68. Originally, he didn't want to have anything to do with Tibetan Buddhism because he had heard this black magic and superstition as to deal with sex, but then he saw how happy these people were despite what they were suffering. So they're very, very earthy, and yet, let me re-answer the question this way. Mm-hmm. Tibetan Buddhism, you can enter it at any level. You can enter it. It can be very, very simple, or it can be very, very complex. Let's just take three bestsellers on the subject. One of them, Harold's book. There is Emotional Intelligence, which is mainly based upon Buddhism, and a lot on Tibetan Buddhism. Mainly on Buddhism, it never even mentions it. So you can get the benefit of it without even sort of buy into Buddhism at all. Mm-hmm. And Harold Cutler's book, it is, I guess it would fall into the category of a self-help book. But this, it is.
The Art of Happiness that you're referring
to. Yes, The Art is the best self-help mm-hmm. book ever written. So he makes the connections with the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism very clear, but you don't have to believe anything about Buddhism. So, or to take the third book that sold between 500,000 copies, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, there you have to really practice it. So probably take a half year to read that book, and yet it sold 1,000,000 copies. Mm. So at whatever level you want, if you just want, you know, like some kind of practical guideline to your life, fine. If you want to really explore like the ultimate meanings of the universe and how you can change yourself in... then you can do that. I attended a monastery was being opened in 1996. The Dalai Lama gave a one-day presentation. It sort of began with ABC so simply, and yet we seem to end up on the other side of the moon where gods and men change places.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Payne, Howard Cutler, standby. I want to welcome into our conversation from Boulder, Colorado, Frank Berliner. He's professor of contemplative psychology and religion at Naropa University. He's been a practicing Tibetan Buddhist for 30 years. Naropa University was the first Buddhist university founded in the United States in 1974. Good evening and welcome, Frank Berliner.
Hi there.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Can you hear me okay if I'm out here?
Yes, loud and clear from the mountains of Colorado.
Very good.
Frank Berliner, give us a sense. We're looking out at this kind of wild popular enthusiasm for the Dalai Lama and the bits and pieces of Tibetan Buddhist teaching that Americans at a popular level are picking up and practicing. Does it reflect something of traditional Tibetan Buddhism? Is this a completely Americanized version of the Dalai Lama's teachings that's going on here? Does the Dalai Lama even teach the full tradition in the United States?
Well, I think it was either Jeffrey or Howard who was making the point about how Buddhism can be presented in a very simple way or a very complex way. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, this is called that it's self-secret. Self-secret means that the capacity of the person who's listening goes so far, and the teacher teaches according to that capacity. And I think that it's part of the Dalai Lama's realization that he teaches in whatever level his listeners are able to hear him. So on the one hand, he's sometimes accused or thought of as teaching Buddhism light, but that's more a reflection of what his listeners can hear than of what he's capable of teaching.
Buddhism light. You've clearly gone beyond Buddhism light.
Definitely. I mean, he also has given a number of traditional empowerments to very large audiences in this country. And some of those empowerments are taken by people who have been practicing meditation for many, many years in the United States. Others are taken by people who just want to meet him and be in his presence. So there are a lot of different ways in this tradition that a teacher actually teaches. And I think one of them, which both Howard and Jeffrey were alluding to several times, is they teach by the quality of their presence. And that's sometimes called authentic presence. And that authentic presence is something that is, it just doesn't happen automatically, but is actually, you could say, earned in some sense through their realization of their practice.
You're saying when the Dalai Lama exudes that kind of incredibly positive, high-humored, compassionate personality. This is not stage acting. This is earned as
a
result.
This is earned. This is real. It's a realization within his own being, and the realization stems from the power of his practice, the practice of meditation. And I think that the really key point here to understand about Buddhism, and many Tibetan lamas make this point, is that Buddhism itself is a Western label for a teaching, which in a way, I should say, it doesn't exactly distort it, but it turns it into kind of a theoretical construct. What the Buddha referred to his teaching as Buddha Dharma, and the word Buddha simply means awake. The word Dharma means the truth of things as they are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's awake to the truth of things as they are. And when you're in the presence of someone like the Dalai Lama, you're in the presence of someone who is experiencing things as they are in that wakeful, gentle way. And the reason that they're experiencing it that way is through the power of their practice. And that's ultimately what they teach. In other words, without meditation, people can receive the blessing of a teacher's presence, but in order for them to actually realize that for themselves, the practice of meditation is key.
Jeffrey Payne, if I may, you wrote recently in the Boston Globe about how Tibetan lamas, when they came out of the country after China coming in, gradually came in contact with the American public and came to understand what the American public could and could not sort of easily take from Tibetan Buddhism. You quote a lama here saying, "Modern people want a path shorn of dogma, fundamentalism, exclusivity, complex metaphysics, and culturally exotic paraphernalia, a path that can be integrated with ordinary life and practiced anywhere." How did Tibet's lamas, even before the Dalai Lama, figure out the American appetite for what they had?
Is that a question for me?
For Jeffrey Payne, if I may, Frank.
Thanks.
They paid close attention. They really studied very closely what Westerners wanted, how they thought. The two lamas who were most influential were named Lama Yeshe and Chergyen Trungpa, who founded Frank Berliner's Naropa University. Lama Yeshe would do anything to understand. He was a man, he was always laughing, but he was a man that no scandal ever touched, but he insisted on going to nightclubs, to gay bars, to beaches, just to see how Westerners thought. And he was always observing them. And so it was this close observation. And they thought what they have could have been adapted to anybody's level. And that's why it's very interesting to see the Dalai Lama in different contexts. Because you ask, is this a watered-down American version? If the audience doesn't know much about Buddhism, yes, it is. I was attending one lecture he gave at the Honolulu Shell, and one of the questions was, what happens when we die? Well, Tibetan Buddhism it's written the Encyclopedia Britannica of Death. It could go on volumes and volumes.
Right.
But he looked out at the audience, and he knew that wasn't appropriate for that audience. And what was appropriate, he said, well, different religions have say different things, but basically speaking, you don't exist anymore. And that was appropriate for that audience.
And there it was. Howard Cutler, let me put it to you. Patrick French, the former head of the Free Tibet campaign, was writing recently in the New York Times that the Dalai Lama, he wrote, has become whoever we want him to be, a cuddly projection of our hopes and dreams. A, do you agree? And B, does that mean, of necessity, a misreading of the man and what he represents?
I don't necessarily agree with that. The subject ties in to what both Jeffrey and Frank were talking about, different levels the teacher can address depending on the audience and the receptivity of the students. One thing about the Dalai Lama that I don't think has been mentioned yet is he's an absolutely brilliant scholar, brilliant man. He has a Geshe degree, which is 17 years of unbelievable study and logic and debate and analysis and all aspects of Tibetan Buddhism. And he he can teach. In fact, just in New York, he gave a couple days talks at the Beacon Theater that I just attended that was so complex and so advanced and such in-depth on the intricate philosophy of Tibetan Buddhism, a discussion of emptiness, the concept of the underlying nature of reality. And people in the audience, unless they were really good Buddhist scholars that have studied for years and years and years who were talking about the depth of his knowledge and understanding and scholarship, it just flew over people's heads. So he can address Buddhism at that level. He's not one of these guys that's Buddhism light. You just see him smiling and laughing. Mm-hmm. He can also address things at a very detailed, complex, philosophical level. And it's amazing to see him engage in debate with these wonderful scholars or with scientists. When they talk about this bridge between East and West, he follows every word in terms of the latest research and science. So I think it's a misconception to think that he's just like a smiling, laughing, fun guy. There is that aspect to him that's genuine part of his personality, but he can also be very, very intellectual. He's a really smart guy.
Mm. We're talking tonight about the Dalai Lama boom. A lot of callers want to join us. Let me turn to them. Scott's calling from Jacksonville, North Carolina. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My original comment now falls, I think, in the professor from Colorado talked about this awakening to and being aware. My original comment was it doesn't surprise me at all that even without knowing anything about Buddhism, that the Dalai Lama is such a phenomenon because I'm 55, I'm a Christian, I'm a military career officer, mm-hmm. but I find myself in prayer for peace far more than I've ever found before. And I think it's a result of having lived through, 40 years of threat of nuclear holocaust, and then we all joyfully saw the world, the wall go down, and
yep.
and we had 8 or 9 years, and then all of a sudden, here we are, 2 years later. We're in a war on terror that really you don't have to be very bright to realize it may never end.
Scott, as a Christian, how do you perceive the Dalai Lama's message?
Oh, I perceive it as a gift from God. I think he is truly a man of peace that I really believe Jesus Christ was as well, and I believe Christ would have the same exact effect and message today. In fact, he does for many, and we also know that for many it gets misused. But I really believe that's who he was when he walked the earth and still does in his spirit and those who really understand him and believe him. And that's the gift to me. I long for peace, and I think that's what people long for in this country.
Scott, we're coming right up on a break, but I can't thank you enough for your call. Thanks so much for calling in. Frank Berliner, we've just got a few seconds, but there's a career military officer and Christian saying he hears the Dalai Lama, and he's responding because the urge for peace is so great.
Yes.
In his heart.
Yes. Can I respond to that?
Sure.
I'm reminded of a quote from Gandhi. He said, "You must be the change that you wish to see in the world." And I think that that's what people from all religions respond to in the Dalai Lama, that they see that, in a sense, his own authentic presence is already the accomplishment of peace, and that peace begins with one's own state of being and then radiates out to other people.
Frank Berliner, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We'll ponder that during the break. We're talking about the Dalai Lama boom. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Dalai Lama boom and America's fascination with Tibet's top Buddhist. I'm joined tonight from Boulder, Colorado, by Frank Berliner, professor of contemplative psychology and religion at Naropa University. He's been a practicing Tibetan Buddhist for 30 years. From Washington, by Jeffrey Payne, author of Re-Enchantment. Tibetan Buddhism Comes to the West, and from New York by Howard Cutler, co-author with the Dalai Lama of The Art of Happiness and The Art of Happiness at Work. You can join the conversation as well. Did you see the Dalai Lama on his current tour, and what was the message, what was the mood when you saw him? Will he go the way of the Maharishi, or is the Dalai Lama's message here to stay? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Arvind is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Arvind. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot. Basically, wonderful topic. And the points that I wanted to make, it looks like your guests have already made it. But basically, I just wanted to say that, you know, there are two reasons, I think, why the Lama is so, so popular without knowing very little about Buddhism. One, he's not at all dogmatic. He doesn't seem to be dogmatic. Okay? And two, the very fact that, you know, from the conference that they had at MIT with the scientists and so on.
This is the conference where they were looking at the potential connection between meditation and
exactly.
physiology, health.
Exactly. So basically, in order to understand the mind, basically, you know, a religious leader who believes that religion and science are so compatible, I think people tend to appreciate religious leaders in this age who actually think that science and religion are compatible as opposed to others who try to be suspicious of science.
So let's get over the old bright line between religion and science or the conflict and say these things can flow together. Arvind, we've got it, and thanks for your call. Jeffrey Payne, a couple of things I want to ask, I'll ask all of you about. But one is, there was an interesting article in the New York Times. This was September 18th, and the headline was, Dalai Lama says terror may need a violent reply. And he quoted the Dalai Lama saying that it was too early to say whether the war in Iraq was a mistake, and that terrorism is the worst kind of violence, so we have to check it. We have to take countermeasures. It seems they go on to say that he emphasized compassion, dialogue, peaceful means. But the headline seems so kind of out of step with the general message that we've heard over the years from the Dalai Lama. Is there something we're missing here?
I haven't seen that article, and I would be very surprised if that was not taken out of context, because I can think of nothing else he said in the past 50 years that is similar to that.
Well, let me put it in a down and dirty way. He went to see President Bush. He has political interests of his own. Is it possible that the Dalai Lama would sort of, trim on this a little bit, compromise in order to curry favor with the president for his political interests in Tibet?
I don't think so, any more than it's possible that Bush would jeopardize relations with China to further the Tibetan cause.
Frank or Howard, did either of you see that or can give us context?
Yeah, Tom, I'd like to respond to that. I didn't read the article, but I heard about it. But I was actually in the interview with the New York Times reporter at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so definitely that headline completely distorted the Dalai Lama's message and what he was saying. And I've heard several people be surprised by that headline. And, it distorted what he said. I was there throughout the whole interview.
Frank Berliner, another question I'd like to put to you. In Patrick French's piece recently, he writes that he says, in reality, Tibetan Buddhism is not a values-free system oriented around smiles and a warm heart. It is a religion with tough ethical underpinnings that sometimes get lost in translation. Are there ethical underpinnings to Tibetan Buddhism that Americans are living in, blissful ignorance of?
I don't think that Americans would find any of the ethical underpinnings of Tibetan Buddhism to be objectionable. They're just common sense, human sense about treating others well. I mean, there are various elaborations of what we sometimes in the West call the Golden Rule. I don't think that that's the problem. I think that there are a lot of cultural trappings in Tibetan Buddhism that Westerners can take on in a very naive way and then think that they're practicing spirituality when really what they're practicing is spiritual materialism. That is, that if they adopt the trappings, somehow something magical is going to happen to them. And I think that's the danger. There's certainly no danger in practicing the basic teachings of Tibetan Buddhism, and they are ultimately they can be ultimately free of the cultural trappings. One of the things that I felt that was extremely powerful about the example of my own teacher was that the founder of Naropa University saw that Westerners could practice meditation, and that there was ways of talking about meditation and what the Buddha taught that Westerners could understand on a secular level. He reminded his students again and again that Buddhism is not a religion so much as it is actually a, I think it was, either Howard or Jeffrey said at the beginning of the program, Buddha said, I teach suffering and its cure. Buddhism is like medicine for an illness. And that's why the practice is so important. It's not a body of dogmas and shoulds, but rather it is a method of investigating why we suffer and a method of finding our way through it. It's basically the teaching on the art of how to be happy. And that's the practicality. I think that's part of what Americans are responding to, because Americans are very practical. They're looking for something that works. I think that the downside of that is that Americans are impatient, and they're also addicted to comfort. And when people find out what's really involved in getting in walking on a spiritual path and actually facing oneself through the practice of meditation, many people will not be able to do that. And I think the beauty of the Dalai Lama is that he knows that, but he's still willing to teach the message on whatever level people can hear it.
Make the invitation, in a sense. Jeffrey Payne, I wonder what you think on that part. I spent some time in Tibet and walked across a lot of Tibetan countryside and out through the Himalayas down into Nepal. That's tough country. And you hear the stories of Tibetan pilgrims who would prostrate themselves, 6 feet at a time along the trails of Tibet to get to the big temples. It's a tough country with some examples of extremely arduous practice of Buddhism. Does it fit meaningfully into the American mainstream? Frank Berliner raises this question of whether Americans ultimately give it the real effort required to realize.
Well, that's what we'll see. It's in every country Buddhism has gone to, it's adapted the features of that country. It took 7 centuries for Buddhism to develop in Tibet. Tibet was a warrior society, and then it took 7 centuries. It's sort of amazing how quickly it's become well known in the United States, and whether it will continue is what we can't predict the future. I was talking to a rabbi who teaches it in Europa. And I asked this rabbi, he's wonderful, and I said, what's a nice rabbi like you doing teaching at a Buddhist university? and his answer, he had the right, his answer was just forthcoming. He said, well, all the things that he had studied in Judaism had gone under the surface, were on the surface in Tibetan Buddhism. So it's kind of like meeting an old friend. If the hard rituals for living that life in Tibet had to be recreated here, such as, like 25 years of meditation or go on meditation retreat, probably it would not. But there are other ways it can adapt to this country, and there is a lot of what you might call a hidden Buddhist history in the West and in America before there was a name for Buddhism. So if you knew something about Buddhism, you could go back through Western history and say, that is Buddhism, but nobody knew it at the time. From Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher said, everything is flux. There is not a better way of saying the basic concept of impermanence. So there is this kind of meeting of the core teachings of Tibetan Buddhism with a kind of underground spirituality that was often considered heretical in the West.
And Frank Berliner, I just wanted to put to you that presence of the Dalai Lama is so remarkable, so strong. It comes across just in his voice. It certainly comes across when you see him. That luminosity, I think of it, though, in relation to people outside Buddhism, the kind of thing sometimes Nelson Mandela or Desmond Tutu sometimes have that. In the old film of Gandhi, you can kind of see it.
Yes,
it's not just the province of Buddhism.
Exactly. But Buddhism does not have a monopoly on authentic presence. It's a kind of a gentle charisma, I suppose, you could say. When the Dalai Lama says, my religion, he was asked what his religion is, and I think Jeffrey alluded to this in his article that was sent to me online, that when he was asked what his religion is, he said, my religion is kindness. He lives that. And what you see in true practitioners in any spiritual tradition, what links Jesus and the Buddha, for example, is the direct manifestation of what we nowadays say walking the talk, of actually authentically expressing the teaching that they're giving, rather than saying one thing and doing another. And I think so many Americans are very, very cynical about spiritual leaders who do not walk their talk, that when they actually encounter one who does, it has tremendous power. And I think that in addition to the fertile soil that has already been cultivated by a number of Buddhist teachers over the last 40 years here, which has made the possibility of the Dalai Lama to come here and have this impact, it has helped to kind of prepare the ground for that.
Clearly has, and with that, I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but Frank Berliner, Howard Cutler, and Jeffrey Payne, thanks to each of you. It's been a fascinating hour. Thanks for joining us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Carol Moseley Braun makes her presidential candidacy official. This is On Point. After several months of standing as the only woman in the crowded field of Democratic presidential hopefuls, former Illinois Senator Carol Moseley Braun officially announced her candidacy today. Moseley Braun has broken political ground before. She is the only African-American woman to have ever been elected to the U.S. Senate. On Point has been bringing you excerpts from all the candidates' formal declaration speeches. Here is Carol Moseley Braun speaking earlier today at Howard University, one of America's premier historically black colleges in Washington, D.C.
America is at a tipping point. If we stay the course that we are on, we won't recognize this country 5 years from now. But if we shift gears, try another way, tap some of the talent that has been relegated to the sidelines of leadership, we can heal and renew and save our country. Just last week, my little 9-year-old niece, Claire, called me into her room to show me her social studies book. Turning to the pages on which all of our presidents were pictured, she looked at me and complained, "But Auntie Carol, all the presidents are boys." Well, I want Claire and your daughters and sons to know that in America, everyone has a chance to serve and contribute. I believe that America is ready to take the next great step in the direction of her most noble ideals of service and merit and equality. This campaign is our way of fighting to give Claire and every American girl or boy not only the opportunity to become president of this great country, but the freedom to decide to lead a quality private life if they choose to do so. There is no greater power, no greater human power than a made-up mind. And we have decided not to let them take away our liberty, our opportunity, our hope for a better future. The time has come to meet the challenge of our founding fathers' vision, and I am prepared to fight for you and with you to revive the American dream of freedom and opportunity. Together, we will break down barriers. Together, we will rebuild and restore our country. And together, we will give ourselves the greatest gift of all, an America we can be proud of. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for your patriotism. Thank you for your energy. We will thank you for your faith in the goodness of this country. We will lift up the hearts of the American people. We will inspire hope. We will renew the American spirit, and we will win. Together, failure is impossible. Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Carol Moseley Braun announcing her entry into the 2004 presidential race earlier today at Howard University in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.